From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the rough and tumble of the presidential campaign season. Critics of the Republican candidate declaring that he had crossed the line offering dog whistles to white voters who fear non-whites. On Alternet, Liliana Segura warned that Republican rallies were starting to feel more like lynch mobs, thronged by white supremacists who wanted to roll back American progress. And here's E.J. Dionne writing in the Washington Post, quote, "Are we witnessing the reemergence of the far right as a power in American politics? Has the Republican candidate become the midwife of a new movement built around fear, xenophobia, racism, and anger?" End quote. But back it up for a moment. Segura and Dionne were not writing about Donald Trump in this case. The quotes I read were from 8 years ago when John McCain was running for president. The same McCain who told a woman at a rally that, "No, ma'am, Barack Obama is not an Arab or a Muslim." This year, a number of conservative writers have opposed Donald Trump, but lately they have taken to blaming Democrats for Trump's rise. They argue that Democrats have been crying wolf for too long, that every 4 years, Democrats claim the Republican candidate is courting racists, is anti-woman, is a threat to the human race, so on and so forth. And now that Trump is here, it's harder to take Democrats seriously. Is this a fair critique? Former Daily Show host Jon Stewart also has some blame for Democrats, but for very different reasons. As he says, they're partly responsible for the rise of Trump, but we're going to get to his critique. That is a separate issue coming up. First, my guests for this hour have been part of the national blog scene for a number of years now. They're Rochester-based, but both write for a left-leaning blog called Balloon Juice. It has long been among the most well-read blogs in the political sphere, so let me welcome them now. Douglas J. He writes under the name Doug J. on Balloon Juice. Doug, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Anthony Mix is here. He writes under the name Mr. Mix on Balloon Juice. Anthony, nice to see you.
Thank you. I'm ready to take responsibility for Donald Trump.
Okay. It's nice to see you. The one thing I would ask you, Anthony and Doug, I've read your work, and gear it back on the language side. We can do this for 1 hour. I know you can. I should also say we initially had a panel of both progressives and conservative writers. I am juggling cancellations today. It happens. So consider this an intervention hour for Anthony and Doug, in which our progressive panelists field the complaints of friends and loved ones who want them to see the light here. Conservative listeners especially, do you think Democrats have been unfair to past candidates? Have they cried wolf all too often? You can call the program this hour. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Now, gentlemen, over the years, John McCain's gotten a lot of credit for that moment in which he kind of talked that woman down sensibly at his rally. Maybe you think he's gotten too much credit for that moment, but doesn't it feel different this year? There's no way I can imagine Donald Trump having a similar moment. Doug, can you?
Yes, I agree with that. Trump is a totally different candidate from McCain. However, I would like to revisit one thing about McCain, which people probably haven't forgotten, which is that he did choose Sarah Palin as his vice president, vice presidential nominee. And I think you can draw a pretty direct line from Sarah Palin to Donald Trump.
I think that's fair. And she was doing a lot more dog whistling during that campaign than he was.
Right. So I don't. Those quotes that you pulled up from E.J. Dionne and I forget who else. If those quotes were made after the selection of Sarah Palin, then I think they have a lot of validity.
Okay, Anthony, what do you think?
I agree. And the other thing is, people get tired of dog whistles. They're supposed to be silent. If you have a constituency that wants to hear those kind of things, the natural progression of things is they get somebody out there who's just going to say it, and that's what Donald Trump is. He's not a dog whistle candidate. He just simply whistles.
Okay, but I guess going back to the point Doug is making here, which is that if you go back 8 years ago, you know, right now, Anthony, your favorite writer, Jonah Goldberg, in National Review, conservative writer, you know, he's been railing on this, blaming Democrats for crying wolf, and he says, John McCain, Mitt Romney, you know, similar critiques have been made every 4 years. And now that there is a real, you know, candidate who resembles some of those complaints, according to Jonah Goldberg, for example, that it sort of invalidates the premise. So Doug is kind of, first of all, saying, look, that's unfair. But Mitt Romney, for example, there were people who said, you know, he caters to a Republican, a country club, white crowd, upper crust, that it was, again, sort of signaling to whites, et cetera. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, you say that like it's a bad thing. I mean, that's his natural constituency. The natural constituency of the Republican Party is white, middle class, or lower middle class, and also for Mitt Romney, white, college-educated middle class. What's interesting about this race is that Trump is losing white, college-educated middle class voters in the ring suburbs. So he's not even appealing to them. But is it so bad that Romney was? I don't know. I was never one to think that Romney really was dog whistling. I mean, he was. I thought he was just pretty much trotting out normal Republican talking points on pretty much most issues.
Okay.
I thought he was a pretty mainstream Republican candidate.
What do you think, Doug?
Yeah, I agree. And I didn't actually. People say all these terrible things Democrats have said about presidential nominees for Republicans for the last few years. No one's really pulled up that many about Romney, except a lot of ones attacking him over the 53% remark, which he did say, and which is, I think, quite reasonable to be offended by. But I think the other thing is this, is that so this claim Jonah Goldberg is making, Democrats are crying wolf. The way I thought crying wolf worked was you keep saying there's a wolf, and then when the wolf comes, nobody listens. Well, Trump is behind by about 6.5 points in the poll. So it seems to me, even if they cried wolf before, they're being listened to this time, too.
But do you take it as any possibility at this point? I mean, are you so sanguine about the chances of Trump's defeat that you think you don't think it's impossible, in other words, that he could win? No. What we know could change the equation are the debates, but also external events between now and early November, right?
Sure, but that would be true whether or not Democrats had criticized Romney and McCain in the past. I mean, I think, you know, what if they had kept their powder dry and now all the stuff about Trump was new, what would he be behind by then? Maybe another 1 or 2 points? I think the way the electorate is aligned right now, nobody's going to win an election by more than 10 points. And, you know, Trump is not that far from that. And Hillary is, you know, Hillary has weaknesses as a candidate. The economy is not fantastic. It's always hard to win a third consecutive term as president. Anytime you're up 6.5 points in a third term election like this with a candidate that is not that viewed that positively, you got to say that people really don't like the opposing candidate. People really don't like Trump. I don't know how much more Democrats could make people dislike him.
Okay.
One more thing on that line of argument. That's a kind of a wife beaters argument. Look what you made me do, right? The theory of the case is that somehow because we criticized Trump, that made Republicans, or that we criticized Romney and McCain, that made Republicans nominate Trump. I mean, just take Jonah Goldberg needs to take responsibility for what his party's done and the lines that he's pushed for many, many years. It's the logical culmination of what he's been saying for years.
That's what I think Doug is making an interesting point as well here when it comes to where the race stands currently, because to Jonah Goldberg's point, if Democrats were to blame for the rise of Trump, then maybe Democrats or maybe the scenario would be a close race or maybe even Donald Trump getting elected. Who is to blame or credit for Trump's actual domination of the Republican primaries? I mean, Democrats weren't participating when right. He was dominating. So right. Let me read a few things from his piece, and then I've got a couple of emails from listeners that I'd like to get to as well here. This is, again, conservative writer Jonah Goldberg. This is the most I've ever quoted him on one show, by the way. It's really remarkable. But this is him on Democrats crying wolf. Quote, you can start the timeline as far back as the World War II era. In 1944, Franklin Roosevelt told the country that if Republicans were returned to power, even though we shall have conquered our enemies on the battlefields abroad, we shall have yielded to the spirit of fascism here at home, end quote. The press nodded along. In 1964, CBS News' Daniel Schorr claimed that Barry Goldwater's planned post-convention vacation in Europe was really an effort to coordinate with right-wing Germans in Hitler's one-time stomping ground. In recent years, as the distinctions between news and opinion, analysis and advocacy, reporting and clickbaiting has blurred, the problem has only gotten worse. All right, so he's going all the way back to 1944. Tony, is that fair?
Of course. Why don't we go back to the 1800s? I mean, Democrats supported slavery. I mean, there we go. I mean, totally invalidates anything we're doing today. I mean, that argument's ridiculous. I don't know why you're... I guess...
Because he's not the only one making it.
Who else?
George Will. Other anti-Trump conservatives are trying to deflect blame, as they see it, to Democrats.
I think that's a sideshow to the real problem. So, I mean, sorry, I'm not picking up what you're putting down.
No,
as
no,
hard
it's okay.
You want me to,
no, I, no, that's no, your job is not to agree with everything.
Well, I just don't think it's a very fruitful line of argument or interesting line of argument. I mean, it's very clear that whatever happened in the Republican Party over this primary had very little to do with what Democrats had to say. I mean, any reasonable observer. And it had a lot to do with the fact that there were like six or seven weak candidates who there's a collective action issue, right? If all of them, one would have dropped out, it would have been the non-Trump candidate. But they slowly dropped out and slowly tried to coalesce, you know, way too late to stop Trump. I mean, that's what really happened here. It's nothing to do with somebody said some bad thing.
In other words, you're more on board with author Stephen King, who not only tweeted that he doesn't buy what he's hearing from conservatives who are opposing Trump. He wrote, quote, "Conservatives who for 8 years sowed the dragon's teeth of partisan politics are horrified to discover that they have grown an actual dragon."
There you go.
Yeah, although, actually, I'm not that comfortable with blaming very much of the rise of Trump on Republican Party operatives. I mean, it seems to me he's mostly a creation of right-wing media, which obviously has worked in some cases hand-in-hand with the Republican Party. But it is, I mean, much to the Republican Party's horror, this election cycle, they discovered right-wing media does have its own independence, does have its own agenda. And I think that's what really drove Trump. I mean, I sort of can see Stephen King's point. I think that McConnell was unusually obstructionist. I mean, you know, some of this thing of not even considering Merrick Garland is, I think, crazy. But I don't think it's the last 8 years of what Mitch McConnell and Boehner and Rentz Priebus have been doing. I think it's 30 years or however long of this rise of this new right-wing media.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. And listeners, again, if you want to call in and weigh in on this, who do you credit or blame for the rise of Trump? And are Democrats complicit in any way? Anthony has already tried to detonate that idea. But if you want to continue with this effort at an intervention with Anthony and Doug Jay, who are here, they're both writers for the blog Balloon Juice, one of the really well-read blogs in the political world. And blogs are not fully fossilized. They're still doing their thing, despite Andrew Sullivan's exit, which, again, Anthony was broken up about a couple of years ago.
I cried that day. I couldn't go to work.
It's 844-295-TALK, if you want to call the program. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. And West Aranquoit, this is Kate. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of respond to the idea that the Democrats have been crying wolf by, you know, calling out racist or homophobic policies in previous Republican candidates. And that, you know, now that we have Trump and now that, you know, it seems that he truly is very racist and homophobic and sexist, you know, I don't think that that means that the people who came before him weren't. I think that he's just brought it to a more extreme level. I don't think that, you know, it was crying wolf before. I think it was trying to call out policies and, you know, ideas that were very harmful. These are just, you know, this is the logical culmination of them kind of going further.
Well, hold on. Stay there, Kate. I mean, Doug and Anthony, I suspect that you're going to agree with just about everything you heard there. Any dissent or anything to add there, Doug?
Well, I think maybe it's a culmination, but I think as a candidate, I mean, there's all these different threads here. But I think as a candidate, if I compare Trump to, say, Romney or McCain, he really is very different. You know what I mean? I think that some of his rhetoric is a culmination of definite types of rhetoric that were going on within the Republican Party and even more so in right-wing media for the last 30 years. But I do think that as a candidate, he is markedly different. It's complicated.
Okay. Anthony?
I agree with that.
Okay. Kate, anything you want to add there? I mean, I guess, you know, to Doug's point on how different the candidates are, I can think of, you know, just go back to the most recent election, both Mitt Romney and Donald Trump favored some form of more expanded health care and then are disavowing that as they run. You know, both are wealthy guys who have either made a lot of money in business or were given a lot of money and sort of did middling jobs in business. But, you know, do you see any other similarities or differences? You know, what do you think, Kate?
I mean, I would agree that, you know, Donald Trump as a candidate is a different breed of candidate than we've seen. But I don't really I kind of disagree that he's a very, very different as like a man, as a person. I think that it's just maybe his candidacy is being a little bit more honest with, you know, like expanding the ideas that he feels and that his supporters believe. And I mean, I also think it's possible that he is, you know, not possible. I think it's likely that he is kind of pandering to, you know, the ideas that get fired up. And as you mentioned before, the, you know, feeding into the media. But Kate, no, I think that they both made very good points. I agree with what
But Kate, the one thing there is you say, you know, you don't think he's that different a kind of person. And this is where, at least observationally, I would just part company there. You know, I think this is some of what maybe Jonah Goldberg and others are getting at when they are talking about the way we talk about Trump vis-a-vis, you know, Romney, McCain, maybe even George W. Bush, previous Republican candidates, which is that you really think Mitt Romney was as overtly willing to exploit the fear of the other? I mean, Mitt Romney strikes me as a pretty nice person, you know, who may actually care about others' goodwill and welfare. It's just, I think, maybe a little bit limited background and perspective given his life circumstances, but it seems like a nice person. You know, Donald Trump let a great grandnephew potentially die from lack of health care coverage because of a family dispute. You know, as David K. Johnston described last week, the author of a new book on him, I just couldn't see Romney doing that. You know what I mean, Kate?
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay. Well, I mean,
he did drive around with a dog on the top of his car. Let's not forget that. I'm just kidding.
That will always come back to haunt. I don't mean to be laughing, but by the way, please, animal welfare people, do not call the show. And I'm not laughing at a dog suffering. I'm laughing because that has never escaped. He's never been able to get past that family vacation moment there.
But you know, that brings up an interesting thing about Trump. Mitt Romney did that one relatively minor thing, depending on what your position on dogs driving on top of cars is. But Donald Trump does that every single day. Trump is a fire hose of error, of political error. It's unbelievable the level of error and miscalculation and just plain out bad campaigning that comes out of Trump compared to any other normal candidate.
Okay, and see, this is where I was going with this. So do you really believe, Anthony, you were sort of grimacing a little when I said, Mitt Romney strikes me, even if you didn't like him as a political leader or think his policies would hurt people, I don't think he intentionally is a bad guy, do you?
No. Okay. I think Mitt Romney's a good guy. I think he's a relatively good person. I don't know. I don't agree with any of his policies. I think he belongs to a religion that's a little patriarchal, but it's also interesting that Trump is really not polling very well in Utah because he lacks the values.
The McMullen momentum or the McMentum.
Because he lacks the values that Mitt Romney had. Right. I mean, the voters, Utah voters, value voters are voting for Romney because they shared family values.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Doug?
I think Romney is a really hard candidate to pin down because he's been, you know, so when he ran against Ted Kennedy for the Senate, I think in the 80s, he said that he would be a stronger advocate.
I would say 90s. Yeah.
He would be a stronger candidate he'd be a stronger advocate for gay rights than Ted Kennedy would. He also, of course, passed Obamacare in Massachusetts. I think if you look at his record up to when he started to run for president, I would say he was pretty solidly left of center despite being a Republican. And actually, you know, being a Republican in Massachusetts or New York doesn't necessarily mean you aren't left of center. And then I think when he ran in 2008 and in 2012, he really had to shift things around. I mean, I always thought to me it was amazing that one of his big campaign issues was opposing Obamacare when he himself had signed a very, very similar law into effect in his own state. So I don't know. Romney is tricky, but I do think that he certainly is a position changer in the same way that Trump is. I guess also I don't know that Trump is a bad person either. I mean, I haven't been happy with a lot of Trump's rhetoric, but you know, I've never met the guy. I've never spent time with the guy. I mean, I'm not ready to say Romney's a good person, Trump's a bad person. I don't feel like I know them well enough. I could really just comment on what their campaigns are like.
All right. Well, let me read a couple of emails on different sides on this, both from self-described Democrats. Brian writes, Evan, thanks for taking the subject on. I'm a Democrat, a Hillary voter, and maybe I'm unusual, but I'm not just voting against Trump. I'm happily voting for Hillary. Having said that, I'm a bit embarrassed by the way my party has talked about Republicans apart from Trump. Okay, apart from Trump and Ted Cruz and Sarah Palin. Look at Mitt Romney. I think he would have been a bad president, but not because he's a bad person. I think he's probably one of the nicest people who have ever run for the presidency. I think he has genuine goodness in his heart. How was he described? As an evil corporatist, someone who would gladly make children starve if he could make himself another million. That's a caricature, not a serious critique. And now here we are with a man who walked out of the dreams of the white supremacist movement, but we're basically using the same language with Trump that we use with Mitt Romney. Of course we've cried wolf before. Thanks for listening. That's Brian. Okay, so just flat out, you simply disagree, Anthony.
On that evil corporatist rhetoric, I mean, I think he's characterizing it as strong as it was, but there was a real issue behind that, right? Mitt Romney went to companies and liquidated them, right? And outsourced the jobs. That's a 100% legitimate campaign issue. It should have been raised. It was raised in like very dark tones, and maybe people think it was a little hyperbole there, but that was absolutely a legitimate issue and should have been pinned on Romney, and he should have talked about it a lot. It should have been talked a lot in debates. That's a real political issue. There's a difference between character assassination and real political issues.
Okay, and just on the issue of Bain, and we're not going to relitigate Bain here, right, but I think Romney himself and probably his past supporters would say he did do that, but some of that was at least ostensibly for the health of the company or to recognize a company that might not have had much of a viable financial future going forward.
Then let's have that conversation.
Sure. Okay. Right. Okay. But in other words, you're saying that the whole evil corporatist, what Brian is emailing, he may be overstating what we said about Romney, but there's at least a valuable question on whether what he did hurt people.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Doug?
So I guess I sort of feel this about this whole thing about Democrats saying mean thing about Republicans, which is that parties are supposed to say negative things about each other. It's not a, you know, that's how politics works. As you say, one of the things that you try to do is say negative things about your opponent. There's nothing new in that. And I feel like this whole notion that the Democrats said mean things about Republicans, therefore they nominated Donald Trump. I think, you know, Republicans have said as much or more mean things about Democrats, and we didn't nominate Alan Grayson.
Okay,
or Jill Stein.
but I think you can boil it all the way down to the idea that if you say fascist every 4 years, fascist, 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 and then when there's actually a non-zero chance that someone would behave in fascist or authoritarian terms there, who's going to believe you when you're saying fascist?
Well, obviously most voters, because Trump is behind by a lot.
Okay. I take that point. Here's the other email, though, that kind of flips the side here. It comes from Sean, and Sean says, Evan, I'm a Democrat, but reread your own intro. The writers 8 years ago were not saying that McCain was racist. They were saying he is embracing a large portion of the population that is clearly racist, and he doesn't have trouble understanding that that's how he could build his campaign. That's what's been going on. You have leaders of a party understanding what kind of support they have, and they're not turning it away. They're encouraging more of it. That's what Sean says here.
Absolutely. And let's go, since Jonah Goldberg likes to reach back into history to cherry pick, let me go back and do something that isn't cherry picking. Talk about the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, both of which were passed by a Democratic Congress being whooped by LBJ. And after that was passed, LBJ famously said that the Democrats have lost the South for a generation. Absolutely right. Who took over the South? The Republicans. The Republicans now own the South. They have the solid South behind them. And in order to win in the South, they are, dog whistling, whatever. They've got a constituency down there that wants to hear the kind of things that Donald Trump is saying, you know, for better or worse.
Let me go ahead and read just a couple of other quick emails before we're going to shift in a second to another criticism of Democrats. Came from John Stewart about why Democrats are at least partially culpable for the rise of Trump, but it's very different than the kind that we've been hearing from some of the conservative writers who remain against Trump. Robert writes to the program and says, I find this notion that the left is responsible for Trump absolutely ridiculous. Yes, every year, far left-leaning individuals say the GOP candidate is Hitler, but the GOP loved Trump when he was pushing for a birth certificate. They embraced the Tea Party, and that's why you have individuals like the governor of Maine saying that people of color are the enemy. The GOP was perfectly fine blocking all legislation and just being obstructionist for 8 years, convincing their base that immigrants and Obama are the problem. The GOP brought Trump onto themselves, reap what you sow. That's from Robert. Once again, you're going to, is that preaching to your choir?
Well, just to follow up on the LBJ comment, find me one Republican in a major office today who has anything like the strength of character that LBJ did, even an iota of that strength. Only person I can think of is Richard Hanna, who retired this year, who basically said he's voting for Hillary. He's a representative from the 23rd District, I think, over Utica way.
But he is retiring.
He's retiring.
And it's easier to be in that position when you don't have to get reelected. Right. Jeff Flake, though, didn't attend the convention, Senator Flake from Arizona. There are a few others. He hasn't said he's going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but Jeff Flake has said this is not the kind of candidate I can support. I mean, that.
Yeah.
Do you point to Jeff Flake and at least feel that there's...
No, more like to see more like him.
Okay. And by the way, Robert emailed and mentioned the governor of Maine, which I think is still just a few days old, that kind of controversy. If you missed that, he didn't really, Robert did not describe it inaccurately. That's something worth going back to see if you missed that. So let's get our only break of the hour and we'll come back and we will listen to what former Daily Show host Jon Stewart said in terms of, are the Democrats at least partially to blame for Donald Trump? My guests for the hour are both bloggers and political writers for the website Balloon Juice. Douglas J is here. You can find him under Doug J on the site. And Tony Mix is here, Mr. Mix on the site for Antoine. And it's nice to see them in person here. They're both Rochester natives, but it's a nationally, nationally read, and it has long been one of the really well-read political blogs on the scene. Let's get that break, come back to more of your phone calls and more conversations next. Coming up in our second hour, the news of an exoplanet, one star system away, that might be habitable, and it might be Earth-like in size. And maybe it could be the future home for the human race. Whether it's climate change or the sun giving out, whatever caused us to leave this planet, could this be where we go next? It sounds crazy. We will explore it next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Alzheimer's Association of Rochester and the Finger Lakes Walk to End Alzheimer's this fall in Rochester, Canandaigua, and Brockport. To register for a walk, visit alz.org/RochesterNY.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll go back to the phones now. Jason in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Jason.
Hey, hello. How are you doing?
Good.
I love the subject of today's show, and I was trying to hold my fire hearing Jonah Goldberg's name mentioned so many times because that's a dog whistle to me. But I couldn't help it when I finally heard that. I don't know if your guests were paraphrasing or not that Goldberg had said. You call a Republican a fascist with every election cycle, and then you're surprised that you know people think you're crying wolf. I think it's that's quite rich when you consider that, as your guests probably know, Jonah Goldberg published a book a few years ago called Liberal Fascism.
Yes.
Its calling card was a bright red cover with a yellow smiley face with a little Hitler mustache scribbled on it, which everyone who enjoys the book seems to, have their enjoyment of it seems to be entirely encapsulated in the cover. But this is a book that Goldberg wrote that basically found, you know, the roots of fascism and absolutely everything having to do with the Democratic Party. You know, It Takes a Village was fascist. JFK's, The New Horizon, that was fascist. The Dead Poets Society was fascist. The Matrix was fascist. page after page of where left-leaning fascism can be found in every corner of our society. And then he has the nerve to come out and complain that that liberals throw the word fascist around a little too easily. So I just wondered if your guests were familiar with this book and if they had any comment on it, especially given today's circumstances, because you can be sure that nowhere in liberal fascism will you find any reference to Donald Trump.
Jason, not only thank you for that phone call, I'm embarrassed that this hasn't come up yet on the program, and I'm a little let down that Anthony and Doug haven't alighted on that. You know the book well, right? I assume.
Yeah.
It's on your own nightstand, probably.
Yeah, it has that. There's some line from the Dust Jacket blurb about, what is it, an argument that has never been made with this clarity and precision before, or something like that. The people, it's sort of become like a kind of a minor internet meme. So, but I feel like you picked Jonah Goldberg, but you who's a joke. But you mentioned George Will, who's less of a joke. So I sort of felt like, why not just try to take
to humor the argument. No, it's true. I mean, Doug's right. Goldberg is not the only one who's made this argument that Democrats are to blame with their hyperbolic language. And now that you've got a hyperbolic candidate, well, what else did you expect? But that's a great point, Jason. Goldberg did write a book called Liberal Fascism.
Taxed my patience and my ability to suppress my curse words, this whole Jonah Goldberg thing, because I have so little patience for the argument, look what you made me do. That is the that is an argument that's not accepted by anybody in real human life. You know, if your kids said it to it, you'd, you know, slap them upside the head or whatever's appropriate punishment nowadays. It just isn't acceptable. Yet somehow, Donald Trump, look what you made me do. I don't buy it at all.
Well, let's listen to a different argument then for why maybe Democrats are at least complicit in the rise of Trump. And that comes from former Daily Show host Jon Stewart, who was a guest on David Axelrod's podcast called The Axe Files. What do you guys think of that, by the way? You listen much? No?
I haven't, no.
Okay.
Like Axelrod's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed the conversations I've heard. One of the guests was Mitt Romney, we've been talking about, but he's had a number. And he had Jon Stewart on, and here's what Jon Stewart told David Axelrod. And he also could not suppress some of his curse words, but we have bleeped it. Let's listen.
The door is open to an like Donald Trump because the Democrats haven't done enough to show to people that government that can be effective for people can be efficient for people. And if you can't do that, then you've lost the right to make that change, and someone's going to come in and demagogue you.
Okay, that's a very different argument. The Democrats, progressives, have failed to explain to the population at large that the word government is not a pejorative, that it can do some good things. I immediately think of how when the Affordable Care Act was passed, Democrats running for Congress almost immediately went into shells and allowed right. themselves to get run over. And I think that's the point Jon Stewart's making. Is that a valid one, Anthony?
Yes. It's called the defensive crouch. It's the state that Democrats get into whenever they're running, when they're afraid to actually run on their achievements. And they're trying to basically triangulate and move over a few supposedly persuadable Republicans over to their column. I don't think it works. I think Hillary Clinton's campaign this year is kind of showing she would have been more of a defensive crouch type candidate a few years ago. I think she's basically abandoned that, and she's running pretty loud and proud on Democratic principles.
Okay. Doug?
Yeah, I agree with Jon Stewart on this very much. I agree very much with what Tony just said about Democrats not fighting enough. I don't know when it happened. I mean, I only really started to follow politics myself maybe around 1989, 1990, but in all the time that I've been following politics, there really is this sense that Democrats are afraid that, you know, that they don't, you know, they don't want to be loud and proud. Maybe if they're from New York, they do, but nationally, there's this thing that you have to be a centrist.
Anthony Weiner was loud and proud.
Anthony Weiner,
which is a whole
right,
other thing.
Right. But I mean, but nationally, I feel like there's this thing. I'm not really a liberal, and you know, I got to appeal to the people at the Applebee's salad bar who may be socially conservative, and I got to talk about V-chips and school uniforms and super predators all the time.
And rap music.
You know, yeah, you got to condemn. You got to get in there, and you got to put warning labels on all the records to keep the kids from, you know, hearing all the devil messages. And there really is, and you know, those are all things that I just mentioned. There were pushed by Democrats and. '90s and I think that there's this sense that it's always that it's always the early '90s that cycle of Democrats always having to be on the defensive. It's still a big part of our politics.
All right, but the 2 points I want to ask Anthony about here before I get back to your phone calls. It's one thing to say Democrats or Republicans or whatever party needs to stand up and fight for what it has achieved legislatively, its principles, and if you don't, expect to get steamrolled. In this case, the argument is Democrats are more likely to roll over and get steamrolled by Republicans. That's the argument that Stewart's making. It's another to say that when that happens, it's more likely to lead to a candidate like Donald Trump. Do you buy that connection?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so that's not a connection you buy.
I do a little bit.
Oh, okay. This is much more interesting. Let's hear some disagreement. But let's start with Anthony. Why? He's saying that you are opening the door to a demagogue if you allow the public perception of government at all to be instantly negative.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you're saying. Okay, if you're opening the door to demagogue by not standing up for your principles.
Yeah, and in this case, the idea that the government doesn't...
That's generally true. If nobody's making a full-throated defense of those principles, for example, the notion that there's an independent federal judiciary and that a federal judge, no matter what their race, creed, color, religious background, can fairly judge... That has come out in this election, and people have come out for that loud and proud. Planned Parenthood, another great example. If you're not going to be, you know, Democrats were very wishy-washy about their support for Planned Parenthood. Hillary Clinton is not. There's nothing wrong with from the perspective of 60 to 70% of the country, Planned Parenthood is an organization that they believe in. When you're on a side of, when you're on a side of something that's 60% approval, something like that, you should come out and support it, because there's another example of something that's been eroded. Yeah.
Okay, Doug?
Well, I also think that part of what's really empowered Trump is this really extreme cynicism about government and, right, and the system. This idea that people voting, you know, the system is rigged seems to be one of Trump's key lines that he applies to not just electoral, you know, not just elections, but also how our society works in general. And I think there's no question that this feeling that a lot of Americans have, the system is rigged against them, that they need somebody who will totally break the mold. That definitely contributed a lot to Trump. And I think it's definitely true that the Democrats too often have, you know, this sort of anti-government message got very powerful. And I think too often Democrats, you know, played along with it or played footsie with it. I think that's very legitimate.
All right. Carol writes to us and says, regarding mean words about opposing political parties and candidates, actions speak louder than words. If a candidate is not misogynist or racist, prove us all wrong. And she adds, choosing Sarah Palin as a running mate was not a big win for women politicians or women who want to go into public service. So that's from Carol. Greg writes to the program. Hold on a second here. Let me grab another phone call, because I'm just getting a deluge of email on this subject. Let me grab Carlos in Union Springs next. Go ahead, Carlos.
Hi, it's Carlo, actually.
Oh, Carlo. Go ahead, Carlo.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, you can't run away from reality. During the second debate before Obama's election, Newt Gingrich called him the food stamp president. Ronald Reagan talked about the welfare queen in Harlem. That's the message. And after Obama won again, I heard Republicans moaning. You know, bullies very quickly become whoops, you know, when you stand up to them. I heard him moaning about reaching out, blah, blah, blah. So what did we see? We saw in states with Republican majorities in assemblies and governors, we saw the most restrictive voting rights in decades. And what's his name? Nixon tried it on the Gonzales out in the Mountain West. And it's statistically proven to be zero voter fraud. But, you know, they rely on the amnesia of the public here. That's why Gonzales finally stepped out. But one of the reasons. They fired a bunch of U.S. attorneys who were not being aggressive enough about voter fraud, and the incident was less than 1%. So you can't run away from your actual statements and your policies. On the other hand, I do agree that Democrats need to stand up and smack down this stuff a lot more aggressively. And I'll take your answer. You know, I'll take your answer off the thanks.
Carla, thanks for the phone call. Doug, you want to start? Go ahead.
Well, that's actually an issue that really does go to the idea that some of this racial stuff that Trump's really capitalizing on has been brewing for years, because the voter fraud, the voter ID laws, they're total nonsense. There really is almost no voter fraud, and if you look at that law that was struck down, I believe in South Carolina, right? They specifically they first solicited information about what types of ID people from white people versus black people were likely to use, and they immediately disallowed all the forms of ID that were more likely to be used by black people. I mean, and this is in the service of a nonsense issue of voter fraud. There really is very little voter fraud in the United States right now. So, yeah, I think that is a really good. I mean, I think it's really tricky. The Republican Party is a big entity, and in terms of, you know, do you blame the party or who do you, you know, individuals, it's tricky. But I think when you look at something like this voter fraud issue, it really is exactly the kind of rhetoric that led to somebody like Trump. And in this case, you have to put the blame on elected officials, not just right-wing media, because this was passed by legislatures.
Tony?
Yeah, another thing to think about is, if you're the Republican Party and this country is going to be majority minority soon, right? You're going to want to win a nationwide election. How are you going to do that? Are you going to do that by trying to reach out, try to do Ronald Reagan's big tent rhetoric and all that? Trump is the absolute opposite of that. Trump is polling at 1% or 2% with African Americans. He's polling at about 20% with Hispanics. Way below African Americans never, in the last couple of elections, obviously Obama being elected kind of moves the polls a little bit, but Hispanics, they're a great candidate for outreach, right? A lot of them are somewhat conservative, would be interested in some of the positions of the Republican Party. Trump has completely alienated Hispanics. I mean, it's hard to overestimate, to overstate what Trump has done to the Hispanic vote. And so if you're going to run a if you're going to have a national party, a true national party, how the heck are you going to have a national party without doing some outreach to minorities who are going to be the majority in this country in a couple of years, if not yet?
Fascinating that pointed out this weekend that both Giuliani and Chris Christie as surrogates are now using the term digital wall or virtual wall with Mexico. And, you know, if he walks back that one, I think he is much more likely to lose supporters who are immigration-based supporters or non, you know, white voters who are concerned about non-whites, as opposed to the idea that he's going to bring more Latino voters into the fold.
Well, let's think about that calculus that you have there for a minute, Evan, that how he's more likely to lose voters to whom? That's another important question. Why is the Republican Party coddling the rightmost part of the Republican Party? The leftmost part of the Democratic Party is anything but coddled. It's basically they're expected to fall in line and support the nominee. I mean, a few of them can go and vote for Jill Stein if they want to, but otherwise, you're voting for Hillary, right? This is not, and you're expected to, and basically you're expected to understand that a lot of the politicians of the Democratic Party have to tack a little bit to the center, to the right, in order to get elected.
You do know there's going to be Bernie Sanders supporters about to call here and dissent to some.
If you look at the polls, there are fewer Bernie Sanders supporters who say they're not going to vote for Hillary in 2016 than there were Hillary Clinton supporters who are not going to vote for Barack Obama. That is a non-issue that's just being whipped up for media attention.
No, that's true. That's true. But Dorothy on Twitter does write, Hillary Clinton is loud and proud for social issues, not economic, not public education, not unions. And Bernie never went into a defensive crouch.
True. And I voted for Bernie Sanders. So,
yeah, I think she's completely right.
Okay. So what we've been getting at this hour is the question on what is the single biggest reason for the Trump rise, because the allegation that, you know, Democrats with their language have been sort of complicit in this by crying wolf. Our guests from Balloon Juice, and that's balloon-juice.com online, Doug J. and Mr. Mix. Tony is Mr. Mix there on Balloon Juice. So you can read them there. They've been writing on that, I call it a progressive-leaning site. That's fair, isn't it, guys? That's
yeah,
okay.
I think so.
Okay. A well-read site for years. They're Rochester-based. I asked them to come in, and unfortunately, the rest of the panel canceled. So it's become this intervention, but Tony has not been able to be moved. He's this obstinate, you know, cold-hearted core regarding some of these issues. But the question is, you know, why have we seen the rise? They've rejected the idea the Democrats' language is to blame for it, or, you know, this fascist is to blame for it. But they've said, okay, maybe there's a point that says Democrats have to be better at fighting for accomplishments, achievements, for what they truly believe government is for and has done. Steve writes to us on Twitter and says, Trump also ran in 2012. No one liked him. He quit in May 2011. So what happened in just 4 years where he's suddenly so popular? Steve, I would only say to that, before I kick it over to our guests on that, David K. Johnston, who has the new book on Donald Trump, was on this program last week, and he said that Trump really did not seriously run until this time around, that this was a very, very different approach, and something did move him to run this time. Trusting David Kay and his reporting work, which is the kind of work I certainly haven't done, I don't know if that's true or not. I understand David Kay's point. But Steve's asking, well, what's different now? This is Donald Trump in 2000 floated the idea of a run. Why did he run this time, and why was he received so much this time?
So I don't think this is that different from 2012. If you look at 2012, it was a very strange election cycle for Republicans, where you had Newt Gingrich at the top of the polls for a little while. And you had Herman Cain at the top of the polls for a while. And now I don't think either one of them said as many truly incendiary things as Trump did. But Newt Gingrich did talk about making the moon into a state, right? Herman Cain answered to most questions with something about 999. So you did have what you might call fairly, I don't know, non-standard, alternative, you know, clownish, some might say, candidates doing really well in 2012. So I don't think that much has changed since 2012. I think it's basically Trump wasn't serious in 2012. He is serious now.
Agreed.
All right. Tony's going to co-sign on that. Well, here is a registered Democrat voting for Jill Stein who wanted to email the program. It's Teresa in Webster, and she writes, Evan, I'm not sure if the historical context of right-wing fascism is being taken into consideration at this discussion. Fascism has and fascist rhetoric has always gained a foothold in oppressed populations, suffering economically with little hope for change. The obvious example of this is the rise of Hitler and the Great Depression and hyperinflation of post-World War I Germany. Therefore, the blame for Donald Trump lies squarely on the shoulders of the Democrats that have perpetuated economic policies that continue to leave the oppressed behind and push for trade deals that make those same populations feel as though no one is fighting for them, but just the opposite, trying to ship their jobs overseas. The Democrats could have stopped the Donald's race in its tracks by nominating a candidate that offered a different kind of change to these same oppressed people. Teresa is effectively arguing that Sanders voters and Trump voters are not that different, and that by nominating Sanders, Trump wouldn't have had the same argument to the general population. Anthony.
I don't really know how to respond to that. I think it feeds into this unreal notion that it's simply an economic argument that's happening among Trump supporters. And I think anybody who's done a lot of research on it, there's a lot more going on there. There's a tribal argument. There's a lot going on with Trump supporters that has nothing to do with the objective facts of their economic situation. And I think the idea that I'm sure there's some persuadables that could have come over to some of the populist positions of Bernie Sanders, but I really don't honestly see a lot of Trump supporters being swayed. They're much whiter, much poorer, much more Southern than somebody who'd vote for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I don't think Bernie would be doing much better than Hillary. I think there's this sort of trap that happens where, you know, this especially to Democrats, but I think it happened to Republicans too in this primary where whoever the Democrats put up, right, will be attacked by Republican media, and by the time they're through with them, they're not going to look that great. You know, there's going to be a lot of dirt on them, and so no matter who you put up, they're going to have some dirt on them by partway through the election, and then people say like, "Oh, this is a terrible candidate. We should have had this other candidate." It's there's something about it that really seems unfair to me. And by the way, I think the same thing happened to some extent with this Republican primary where whoever the establishment, I think it was not going to be a strong election. It was going to be tough sledding for whoever the establishment Republican was. And so, you know, I think Jeb maybe had unique vulnerabilities being the brother of W. But I think that to some extent, whoever their establishment person was going up against Trump, that person was going to get beat up. And instead of saying, "Oh, well, this is a tough environment for establishment candidates," people were going to say, "Oh, that just shows this person is a terrible candidate."
All right, a couple more quick listener questions and comments. Greg, here's the email from Greg. He writes, Evan, conservative Republican listener, thank you for addressing this subject. I can't help but feel that if Marco Rubio were the nominee, we would be hearing the same language, that he could be a fascist, he could be an authoritarian, he would be anti-woman, he's catering to racists, he would be dangerous. Wouldn't they be saying the same about Rubio? And if the answer is yes, then that is the conviction that we need to say Democrats' language has to change. He says, by the way, I'm voting Gary Johnson. That's Greg right in the program.
Good for him.
Okay.
Good for him.
But
vote your principles, Republicans. Vote Gary Johnson.
Okay.
A Republican governor with another Republican governor.
Okay, but that you seized that opportunity, Anthony. But his point is, he thinks if Rubio were the nominee, we'd be hearing roughly the same rhetoric.
Let me ask him this question: can he explain Marco Rubio's position on immigration? And then the follow-up question is: can he explain Donald Trump's? Donald Trump's does not have positions. Donald has whatever came out of his mouth that day. That is not Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio would be, the other thing about Marco Rubio is he'd be running a campaign. Donald Trump is not running a campaign in the traditional sense of the word. He doesn't have the field organization that a regular, standard issue Republican would have. So there are many things about Donald Trump that are very different from how Marco Rubio would run a campaign. And there's a lot of things that are said about Donald Trump that would not be said about Marco Rubio just because they wouldn't be true.
Okay. Doug?
Well, I guess I can tell you one thing that would be different if Rubio was the nominee, which is you wouldn't have Republicans calling him a fascist. I mean, that's what's a bit unique about Donald Trump is that probably the most the sort of toughest put down I've seen from Trump is by Donald Kagan, a neoconservative, I think the title was something like, "This is how fascism comes to America." Now, I didn't really agree with it myself, but this was an example of a conservative calling Trump a fascist. So I do not think you would see that with Rubio.
All right, I think that's a good point. And lastly, we've got 30 seconds left. Then people have been asking, okay, then what's the single biggest rise? What do you point to? Tony, what's the single biggest reason that Trump is successful this year?
Conservative media.
Conservative media. Yeah. Doug?
Same thing.
You agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, by far. I don't think anything else really even registers.
Right. Have you checked with Matthew Dowd and Ron Fournier on that?
Incivility.
They would say incivility. Yeah.
Too much partisanship, you know?
Yeah, right. Not listening to the middle. Okay, so we didn't really move them very much on this notion of Democrats accepting blame, other than the idea that maybe Democrats should not be steamrolled when policy goes through. When you pass an Affordable Care Act, when you fight for legislation, then you have to campaign on it. And I think the president was disappointed with the Congress that they were not really willing to campaign, for example, on that. But I want to thank our guests. You can read their work on Balloon Juice. Douglas J. Doug, nice to see you. Thanks for being here. And Anthony Mix, who writes under Mr. Mix there. Tony, thank you very much there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break, and one of our favorite guests on the program, Adam Frank from the University of Rochester, is up next to tell us about our new Earthling home, should climate change really go awry. That's next.